The Song of Songs, chapter 6, where we'll be this morning. Back in the late 70s into the 1980s, there was every year a special, it was about 3 or 4 days on TV, a special program called Battle of the Network Stars. This was back in the days before internet, cable, streaming, any of that. All there was the airwaves to our television sets. And back then, you only had 3 major networks. You had ABC, American Broadcasting System, NBC, National Broadcasting System, and CBS, which stands for the Columbia Broadcasting System, believe it or not. And then there was also PBS, which is a public broadcasting system. But the 3 big ones were the major networks, and that's all you had. So on your television, young people, you had 4 channels. Okay? Actually, Naomi grew up on a remote farm in Minnesota. They had 3 channels, and 2 of them were 9. I think one was really snowy, and one was really, really snowy. And that's all you had. And so, you know, these networks had their own television shows, dramas, sitcoms, cop shows, that sort of thing. And then every year, they would get all of the stars of all of these shows to compete against each other in Olympic-type games. And like I said, it went on for a few days, and then they'd broadcast it on TV. And it was a hit to everybody watch their favorite star competing against other network stars. And it was called Battle of the Network Stars. Why was that such a success? Well, because people like competition. That's why. It's why sports is such a successful industry. It's a multi-billion dollar industry because your average American citizen likes competition. Did you know the Apostle Paul appreciated sports and competition? He forever referred to the athlete as an illustration. I think if Paul lived today, he would be up to speed on the draft picks. He would know what was going on in the NFL. He'd be disgusted with the way it has gone, but he would completely be on board with the competition. There is a place for competition, but people, marriage is not that place. The battle of the sexes is of the world, not of the Lord. Genesis 3:16 was our scripture reading this morning. And it takes place right after the fall when Adam and Eve sinned and God pronounced judgment on Satan, on Adam, and on Eve. Verse 16 is Eve's judgment. To the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. Ladies, the reason it is so painful, the reason you have postpartum, the reason you get so emotional before and after delivery, that's part of the curse of your judgment. And then he says, your desire shall be for your husband, he shall rule over you. And you read that at first, you say, wait a minute, your desire shall be for your husband? How is that a curse? Shouldn't women want to have a desire for their husband? That's not what this is saying. The idea behind this is your desire, ladies, is to rule over your husband and to be dominant. And that is not the way God originally designed Adam and Eve. And when he says he shall rule over you, first of all, the idea of rule does not mean that the husband is to treat the wife like one of the kids. That's not what that means. That is a misapplication of that text. Also, the idea is simply that and I always get in trouble every time I preach this topic. Some lady is going to take issue with me as if this is my fault, that this is what God wrote. Okay? What it means is that the husband has the final say in leadership of his family. That's what it means. He is the final authority. All right? That is not because of the fall. You'll mistakenly think that if you're not careful. He's not saying your husband will have this authority because of the sin. Hardly. Paul pointed out that God set up marriage to be this way when he designed Adam and Eve. It was before the fall that God said the final authority of leadership lays with the husband. And some of you ladies are already getting angry at me, and you're starting to get hot under the collar. This has nothing to do with some idea that men are superior to women. They are not. Women are not inferior to men. Not at all. We all stand equal before the Lord. In fact, the word helpmeet in Genesis chapter 2, the creating of Eve to be a helpmeet to Adam, the word helpmeet in the original language literally means a face-to-face. She was his equal in companionship. He was given the authority in the family to say the final word, not to treat his wife like a slave, but the buck stops with him, essentially. And if you're still angry at me, take it up with the Lord, okay? This is his word. But because of the fall and because of the sin that introduced into humanity, now one of the things that we got to live with is, ladies, instead of being like Eve was originally, to say, hey, this is the way God designed it. I got no problem with him being the leader of the household. Now ladies have a desire for themselves to be the leader of the household. And this is the problem with the feminist movement of the 1970s. They were right in saying, you got a man and a woman doing the exact same job, and he's getting paid more simply because of man. Now, that's sexist. That actually makes men superior, which is unbiblical, as I've already said. Problem was, that's not where the movement stopped. They just kept swinging that pendulum to say, oh, it's not that women are equal. Women are superior. You see, that's part of the curse for the woman to rule over her husband. That's what Genesis 3:16 says. Means. Now, with this in mind, ladies, I want to point something out to you. You have at your disposal, wives, something incredibly powerful that your husband does not have. And you can use that something either as a weapon against your husband or as a tool for your husband. What am I talking about? I'm talking about sex. And women, wives, have that as a powerful tool. And the reason is men are so visually stimulated. Okay? You unmarried ladies can also use sexuality as a powerful implement, which is why the song says three times, do not awaken love until it pleases. Be careful about that, young ladies who are not married. And that is for your husband someday. Wives, if you choose to rule over your husband and to take leadership over him, physical intimacy is one very powerful way to do it. In the previous section of chapter 5, last week, we saw that the Shulamite wife had declined her husband's intimate advances, and she did so for selfish reasons, not valid ones. Well, this next section in chapter 6 shows the toll that can take on a marriage, not just when this happens once or twice, but is repeated, and what this can do to a husband. So in verses 4 through 10, I want you to see, number 1, there is once again a battlefield in paradise. There is a battlefield in paradise. Take a look at chapter 6, verse 4. The song, chapter 6, verse 4, is where we left off last week. It says, this is the husband speaking again. And he, of course, forgives his wife. And he's once again commenting on her, as he is so prone to doing. And he says, oh, my love, you are as beautiful as Tirzah, lovely as Jerusalem. Those are both words for Jerusalem or Israel. Beautiful. Tirzah and Jerusalem are beautiful in cities. There are such things as beautiful cities. Okay, he says, you're just lovely. He says, awesome, as an army with banners. And then he says, turn your eyes away from me, for they have overcome me. Your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep which have come up from the washing. Everyone bears twins, and none is barren among them. He has said this before. He's also said, like a piece of pomegranate are the temples behind your veil, meaning, so her hair is beautiful and flowing, her teeth are white, and they're all there, and her skin has color to it behind the veil. Okay, he says, verse 8, there are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one The only one of her mother, she was the only daughter. She had a lot of brothers, but no sisters. She is the favorite one, the favorite of the one who bore her. The daughters saw her and called her blessed, the queens and the concubines, and they praised her. And he says, who is she who looks forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, awesome as an army with banners? So he repeats himself, and that makes sense. This is a song, it's a poem, and poems have refrains that repeat themselves. But also, it's very common for a husband to repeat his compliments to his wife. Naomi and I have been married going on 28 years, and repeatedly I have complimented her on her hair for years. I've never said it looked like a flock of goats, but I do compliment her on her hair and have since the day we started dating. So that's nothing unusual. It's natural to consistently compliment your wife on her strong points. But did you notice there are also some additions that he had not mentioned before? First of all, there is an emphasis on military terms. Twice, verse 4 and verse 10, he uses the symbolic word banner, which was almost always used in the military. War banners, banners of war. Now that's interesting. He's complimenting his wife, who has rejected his advances, and she has done her part to make amends, but it has affected him, so he's complimenting her. But he introduces the idea of war in the marriage. That's interesting. And this time, though, did you notice? He only compliments her face. Whereas in the past, he continues on and compliments her body, but not this time. He didn't do that. Why? Something has happened to distract him from her body. What is it? The events of chapter 5. He says in verse 5, for her to turn her eyes away from him, they overwhelm him. Now, why would he say that? Because remember, men are visually stimulated, and a woman's beautiful eyes will captivate a man, and he does not want her to look away. When he finds his wife's eyes to be beautiful, oh, he wants her to look at him, and he wants to look at her. But here he's saying, oh, don't look at me. The effect they have on me is stimulating, and right now he's resisting that because of the events of chapter 5. See, some have seen this in a positive light here. I don't think so. I think what is happening, and the reason he's not complimenting her on her body, and he doesn't want her beautiful eyes to look at him him to look at her, is because he is losing interest in physical intimacy. Yes, ladies, a husband's motor is always running, but it will run cooler after repeated denials and rejections of intimacy. And that's what's happening here. You know, if a wife wants to have a sexless marriage, and I think the statistics in America are somewhere in the 20th percentile, around 20% of marriages are sexless for various reasons. And if that's what a wife wants, she simply need resist her husband's advances over and over again, and eventually a sexless marriage is what she will have. He will lose not his desire for intimacy, but his desire for her will cool. Now, something else he does different here that he didn't do before. He praises her for being superior to queens, concubines, and virgins who are in his realm. Now, this is both a positive and negative ordeal here. It's very negative in that having concubines and marrying queens simply for political purpose and having a harem of virgins who just follow the king around, this is very negative in that it is a deviation from God's plan for marriage. God meant for one man and one woman to commit to each other for as long as they both shall live. As Genesis 2, you need go no further than Genesis 2 to understand the design of man and woman in marriage. You have to go, Once you understand how something's designed, and then you know what it's used for, and you won't misuse it. Well, the design of marriage is a man and a woman who commit to one another for as long as they both shall live. And anything outside of that, including polygamy, is a deviation from God's plan. And King Solomon got into that. That's why it's believed that the Shulamite wife was really his. All these others were for politics or pleasure, but only the Shulamite was his true love, in which he shared what God intended marriage to be. It's too bad he didn't stick with that. And so this deviates from that. So it's a very negative point in this praise. It's positive, however, in that it recognizes something that husbands, you ought to recognize, and young or unmarried men who might be married someday, that you ought to look forward to, and that is this. Husbands, your wife, the woman you committed to in marriage, is superior to all others in your life, especially pornography. She is superior to that. This husband sets a good example for husbands everywhere, and it is this. You deal with the frustrations of your marriage by doing what he did, cultivating the superiorities of your wife. Cultivate what you find so superior in her instead of the negatives. I guarantee you, every couple that finds themselves in marital counseling goes there with a list full of negatives against each other. And that's all they've been concentrating on for the last several months and maybe years of their marriage. All the things they want to see change in the other. And it's amazing. Yes, any marriage counselor who has dealt with this and has implemented this assignment says, okay, here's what I want each of you to do. Piece of paper, and I want you to write down all the things you want your spouse to change about themselves, himself or herself, so that you can be happy in this marriage. Write down everywhere that he or she needs to change. Oh my goodness, smoke comes off the paper they're writing so much. Sometimes they ask for a second sheet. And then when we're all done with that, counselor will say, okay, here's a fresh sheet of paper. Now what I want you to do is I want you to write down all the things that you need to change about yourself so that this can be a successful marriage. Maybe one thing, think about another. And isn't that just the way it is? You know, nothing wrong with this marriage on my behalf, little old me. You know, I'm just doing my part, but he's the one with all the problems. She's the one bringing all the trouble in. Solomon didn't do that. Solomon was hurt by his wife, and yet he compliments her on the things that are so encouraging to him. Not the things that are sexually stimulating to him, but things that are positive just the same. Husbands, take a lesson. Men, if you plan to be married, this is how you look at your wife. And I find what also makes this positive, he's not giving up, and neither is she. Relationships. This applies to everybody, because all relationships forge ahead and they make breakthroughs when all who are involved refuse to give up, but hang in there with each other. Now, in verses 11 through 13, you're going to see number two, the battle identified. Here's where we get to the nitty-gritty of the battle. It says in verse 11, this is the Shulamite woman speaking. She says, I went down to the garden of nuts to see the verdure of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded and the pomegranates had bloomed. What is she saying? This is poetic. She's not saying she actually went down to a garden. She's saying, I went to see if there was once again physical intimacy in the relationship. That's what she's saying. She's saying, and the reason I say that is because the garden repeats itself in the song as a picture of either her or intimacy with her. The garden keeps coming up as just a symbol of having physical intimacy. She's saying, I'm going there with him to see if he's sprouted, if he's ready again. And then she says in verse 12, before I was even aware, my soul, and that's probably a reference to him, her soul, she calls him her beloved, her soul, my soul had made me as the chariots of my noble people. What in the world is that talking about? These are symbols here. The garden is a symbol of intimacy. Well, what were chariots? used for? More often than not, they were used for war, battle. He says, I went to see if my husband was ready for intimacy, and he swept me into chariots of battle? Huh. Again, a symbol of war, like the war banner in the relationship. And then, with that in mind, take a look at verse 13. It says, return, this is the beloved, return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon you. And then it says, from the Shulamite, what would you see in the Shulamite? As it were, the dance of the two camps? That's a question. Now, that line, the dance of the two camps, that has puzzled a lot of theologians. And it is puzzling. Puzzling poetic language. But considering that we've seen two symbols of war here, the banner and the chariots introduced into this couple's relationship, and there's a conflict between this couple, the idea of two separate war camps is at least plausible, is it not? Might this be a third symbol of war, the war camps? I think what she's saying, what's happening is this. She has hurt him. She wants to go see if now he's ready for intimacy. And what she has found instead is a hurt husband who is not. And they still have a battle between them. Something that has come between their intimate life. That's what's happening. And that's a reasonable conclusion and an extremely applicable one that applies to marriage after marriage after marriage after marriage, does it not? Using intimacy as a weapon to rule over and control the husband instead of using it as a tool to cultivate the marriage, it results in the battle of the sexes. And folks, that's a battle nobody wins. So, verse 13, twice you see the word Shulamite. Did you know this is the only section, the only place in the entire song the word Shulamite appears? It appears twice, right here in this verse. All these other places are headings. We see the Shulamite is speaking. Those are headings. Those aren't the inspired word of God. Those were added by the editors who put this together. But the only place where God used the word Shulamite is twice in verse 13. That's it. Now you got to go back to our very first sermon on this book when we looked at what that word Shulamite possibly means. Remember that the word Solomon is the Hebrew word meaning peace. That's what it means. Shulamite is likely the feminine version of Solomon. Like Michael, Michaela. Solomon, Shulamite. Both meaning peace. What I suggest is the reason that's there in verse 13 is because a conflict is what this couple has, but peace is what they want. And they're about to live up to their names. And when that's the case in a marriage, that both husband and wife want peace, folks, there is always hope. There is always, always hope. In fact, this applies to everybody. There is a hope in any relationship when those involved want peace. When you want peace more than you want vengeance, or more than you want justice, when you want peace more than your own satisfaction, your own desires, or even your own preferences, when you want peace more than any of that, there is hope. Jesus did. He wanted peace more than with you, probably than you wanted with him. He wanted peace so much with sinful people that he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross, Philippians 2:8. That's how bad he wanted it. Now, you get two parties in a relationship that are willing to humble themselves in the fashion of the Lord, you get peace. That's what you get. And that's what they both want. So chapter 7, verses 1 through 10, that really go with this section, you have number 3, peace once again. He did his part, she did her part, and this is what you get. Take a look, verse 1 of chapter 7. There he goes, back to complimenting his wife. How beautiful are your feet and sandals, O prince's daughter. Again, he's done this before, mentioning her in clothes. And I think he's not saying that the clothes make you look good. He's saying, man, you make those clothes look good. It says, the rest of verse 1, the curves of your thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a skillful workman. He's saying his wife is shapely. It says, your navel is a rounded goblet. It lacks no blended beverage. Okay, that's weird. We don't talk like that. We don't use that kind of language. But in the Middle Eastern culture, men are fascinated with a woman's belly button and navel. I don't know why that is, but that is part of that culture, and it has been way back in Solomon's day. And then he says, in the rest of verse 2, your waist is a heap of wheat set about with lilies. Okay, how is she not smacking him now at this point? Okay. Well, again, you got to understand the culture. No, he is not saying that she's overweight or that she looks like she's in her 12th trimester or anything like that. That's not what he's saying. Remember, this was a culture in which your common person, and she was a common person, remember. Okay. These people did not have access to food like we do. They had access to way fewer calories than we modern day Americans do. And they walked everywhere. They burned calories from sun up to sundown just living, whether they worked in the fields, whether they ran a shop, whether she kept the home. They just moved constantly, burning more calories than they took in. What did your average woman look like back then? She wasn't just skinny, she was scrawny, okay? And that was not appealing. So any woman who was at least able to get past the scrawny build, that was really considered beautiful. In fact, for generations and years in multicultures, they liked women with a little more meat on their bones. Just look at the Roman statutes under the Roman Empire, you know, and the Greek statutes and all of that. They preferred that. So he's not saying she's overweight. He's just saying she doesn't look like someone ought to give her a sandwich. That's all. And that's what he's complimenting her on verse 2. Her physique, it just really turns him on. And then he gets back to the stuff he's mentioned before in verse 3. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. No need to add more to that. It says your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes like pools in Heshbon by the gate of Beth-Rabbim. He has taken everything in now, her face, her body. He mentions more on her face when he says, your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon, which looks toward Damascus. So what is he saying? She's got a big nose? No. But keep in mind that the nose is the focal point of the face, ladies. So whether you have one of those cute little button noses or you've been given a Roman nose, either way, it is a point in which your husband ought to compliment you. Okay? It is a beautiful part of your makeup. And he is pointing that out on her. And then he says in verse 5, your head crowns you like Mount Carmel. Now he's talking about her hair once again. He says, and the hair of your head is like purple. Purple was it's just the color of royalty. It's beautiful. It always has been. And back then, it was extremely hard to make. Purple dye was tough to make. So to buy purple clothing was expensive. That's why it was the color of royalty. Usually only royalty could afford it. And it was such a beautiful color. He looked at her, he says, man, your head, the hair of your head is beautiful like purple. Right? Of course, in our day and age, your hair may be purple. Right? That's very popular in this day. B was talking about doing that for a while, I think, you know. B, I say color it while you got it, because when you don't have it, it's gone. And this is really popular today, but he was just simply saying, your hair is gorgeous. Gorgeous. And that's why he finishes verse 5 with a king. And he is a king, is held captive by your tresses, the locks in her hair. Just captivates me. He says, how far and how pleasant you are, O love, with your delights. The stature of yours is like a palm tree Then back to her body, he's fascinated with her breasts. He says, your breasts like its clusters. This is very poetic and explicit language that he wants to have physical intimacy once again. He says, I will go to the palm tree. I'll take hold of its branches. Let now your breasts be like clusters of the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apples, and the roof of your mouth like the best wine. And her response to that is, the wine goes down smoothly for my beloved, moving gently the lips of sleepers, meaning when you kiss me, there will be no resistance. Okay. There will be no resistance like there was last time. He says, and then she says, I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. Success, peace, once again in the marriage. For just a moment, this is marriage seminar time. A whole lot of this series has been a marriage seminar. As you consider chapter 6 and the first part of chapter 7, keep this in mind. God created physical intimacy to be a wonderful part of marriage. And some marriages don't have such intimacy for valid reasons, health, an accident, or just age. But many marriages are not enjoying physical intimacy for invalid reasons. He may have contributed to the problem by using sex as a selfish taking from his wife instead of cultivating love between them. She may have contributed to this by using sex as a weapon instead of a tool. Or she just doesn't feel like it. She gives into her feelings instead of choosing to love her husband. One of the things I repeat over and over again when giving premarital counseling to a couple who's about to get married is this. The husband and the wife are to have the same goal. You got different roles. God created different roles. But your goal's the same. Household management. That's the couple's goal as a husband and wife. Together, they manage the household. That's whether you have kids or not. The day you say I do, you are the household. So I'm not necessarily talking about your physical house or your apartment or your condominium. Husband and wife, you are the household. And you both are responsible for managing you. And physical intimacy is a far greater part of that management than anything else. Okay? Yes, you have to work together to rear your children. Correct. But that's temporary, right? The children are supposed to grow and leave. They're supposed to. But you still have each other. See, that's permanent. And yes, you both have a home to maintain, whether it's a small trailer or apartment, or you got a nice big old 3,000 square foot home, doesn't matter. You have a responsibility to maintain that together. But you know what? You may not, either one of you know how to fix that, so you call a repairman. You could be single, and to fix your house, you call a repairman. You don't have to be married to do some of these things in physical household management. But you do have to be married and living marriage God's way to fulfill physical intimacy. People outside of your spouse can do some of these other duties. Only your spouse can fulfill intimacy the way God designed it. And wives, you have the greater power in this area of your marriage. And many wives have never been taught to cultivate their marriage this way. You've only been taught to cultivate your marriage by keeping a good, clean house, by raising your children, and watching the home fires, and all of that is extremely important. But cultivating your marriage with intimacy, even more so. Tim Little, this would be Paul Little's cousin. He teaches Hebrew at Faith Baptist Bible College, and he was on a blog posting with a whole bunch of men dealing with this subject, this very subject we're talking about. He said, an anonymous husband posted on this website, on this blog, that his wife kept a beautiful home. She was a great housekeeper, but she just didn't desire physical intimacy with him anymore. Several other men chimed in with the exact same sentiments in their marriage. And then one man posted that he and his wife actually have a very healthy physically intimate relationship, but he was so frustrated because She kept a lousy house, and it was always messy. Tim said several of the men quickly all posted, "Shut up and hire a maid." Yeah. You do not have a marital problem because your wife doesn't do the dusting as often as you think. You know, it's like when some of you ladies, I hear you griping, you're having a bad hair day. Don't complain to me. All right? I don't want to hear it. Your hair's not active. Go to Chris and Barb's daughter, Stephanie. Get your hair done, okay? But don't complain to me. You don't have hair issues. And this man did not have marriage issues. If you and your wife are just loving each other, so if she's a little sloppy, you come home and you can turn on a vacuum cleaner as well as she can. And if you got the money, hire someone to keep the house. But you've got a healthy marriage when you have this part of your management in control and thriving. I'll end with this because this applies to everybody, what I'm about to say. Whatever conflict you may have right now, marriage or otherwise, you can still be at peace, joy, contentment, and happiness by doing your part. Joy, contentment, and happiness never, ever comes from what others around you do, but from what you do around others. Use what God gave you as tools of love, not as weapons of war. Father, it is a joy to know that we have been given by you grace to extend grace to those around us, our wives, our husbands, our brothers, our sisters, our parents, our children, our friends. Lord, make us implements of peace, tools of love, and not to war with each other. In Jesus' name, amen.